Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Our show today is a little bit of a special show. It's actually a show that I decided I was going to rebroadcast. It's a show that I did a couple of years back, and it was an interview with a woman named Bai Di. Bai Di is a Chinese woman who grew up during the Cultural Revolution, and she's one of those people out there that upholds the Cultural Revolution. And I thought it would be important for people to hear because I think especially today, when we're in the middle of an upsurge all across the country, where people are going to the town squares with their pitchforks and their torches, not only to talk about how intolerable the world is, but to search for the way the world could be. They've lifted up the veil of thinking that this is the only possible world, this is the best we can do, so we might as well just suck it up and live with it, to actually searching for, saying that not only is the world intolerable, we refuse to live like this, and we want to find a new way of living, a way that would allow the common people to work in common for the common good of everyone, a way that could be a step in the direction of the genuine total emancipation of all of humanity. So without any further ado, let's just start listening to the interview. Today we're going to be talking with Bai Di. We're going to spend the hour talking with Bai Di. Di is a woman who grew up in China under the Cultural Revolution and took part in the Cultural Revolution, and today is a pretty ferocious defender of the Cultural Revolution. And this is very important for people to hear because this is not a view that you hear often, or even, well, it's very rare to hear this view. And hopefully in the future, there'll be more people actually dealing with what was true about the Cultural Revolution, because that's what we're going to be getting into today. We're going to be talking about what was good about the Cultural Revolution, what was true, were there weaknesses? Certainly there were. But overall, primarily, principally, it was an overall positive thing for humanity. And it's important for us to understand that. It's important for us to understand that because if we can't ever know the truth about our own history, about the things that brought about tremendous changes that benefited humanity, we'll never be able to imagine another future. We'll never be able to see that it is not only necessary, but possible. And that's what understanding the truth about the Cultural Revolution is all about. Bai Di is the director of Chinese and Asian Studies at Drew University. She's also the co-editor of Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up in the Mao Era. And Di took part recently in a symposium up at Berkeley, at the University of California in Berkeley. And the symposium was titled Rediscovering China's Cultural Revolution, Art and Politics, Lived Experience, Legacies of Liberation. It was a really fascinating and important symposium. And Di was part of the panel on art and politics in the Cultural Revolution. I am really pleased to welcome my guest for today. Di, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael, for having me.
Sure. It's my pleasure, and actually, I'm really excited about doing this. You know, for listeners, one thing that people who listen to this show regularly know, that I am a revolutionary, I'm a communist, and they also know that I uphold a period of history that, by and large, is vilified almost universally, at least in terms of what you see. You cannot mention the Cultural Revolution in China, the Chinese Revolution, and especially the Cultural Revolution in China, without having someone come up with a whole, just a bucket full of horror stories about what went on there. The whole thing has been universally dismissed and vilified, and it's ruled out of order to even talk about it. Well, in the face of that, Bai Di has stepped out, and she's been speaking and doing a lot of work actually countering the master narrative. Di, I guess actually my first question for you is, I read a comment from you once that said that you commented that you were really grateful to have grown up in an extremely special moment in Chinese history. And you spent your life since then, quite a bit of your life and your effort, in opposition to that master narrative I was talking about revolutionary China and the Cultural Revolution. And it seems to be a really unique effort in the world today. And tell me, is it so unique, really? And why have you come to this point?
First of all, I have to say it's not my own individual effort to do that, because our book, Some of Us, A Chinese Woman Growing Up in Mao Era, is a collective effort by three of us editors, co-editors Zhong Xueping, Wang Zheng, and I. And also we have a group of Chinese professional women right now working in the United States contributed into this volume. And in recent years, more and more people will come out, already came out, and talk about their own experiences in China, especially in the Mao era, we call it. Basically, roughly from 1949 to 1976, when Mao died. So to answer your question, and all of us felt that in the United States and in China right now, there's this master narrative that you have to say that Cultural Revolution in the Mao time, Mao era, was a disaster, was a kind of a atrocity, basically, oppressing people, victimize a lot of people. And the literature will come out, all focused on how they're victimized, how they're persecuted in the revolution. And then that painted kind of a picture that is a gloomy, very dark kind of 10 years of the Cultural Revolution. So when I first came to the United States in 1989, and I came across with this, several memoirs, widely read at the moment. One is Red Azalea, another one is Wild Swan. And then, so I think in the mid-90s, and some of us Chinese women studying in the United States, we had the time, we just got together, and we realized we had to get our own voice heard because we felt kind of angry that 10 years period could be painted as such, it's manufactured as a, such a kind of a period. And then here in the U.S., the popular readers, I mean in the populace of the U.S. will accept that as the true picture of the Cultural Revolution. So then we took up that effort to write this book. For me, the Cultural Revolution formed my childhood, the whole childhood. It was I was born in mid-50s, so I when Cultural Revolution started, I was 11 years old. And right now, when I look back, not only right now, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, when I look back, I have to say that's the best time of my life.
Well, that's very interesting. That's what I wanted to get into a little bit. Why is that? What was it like?
So number one, because I look at things from gender perspective, my major here, I'm teaching women's studies. I think as a girl growing up in that era, it's a zero, very liberating for women and girls. And then I think that we were expected, the society expected girls as good, I mean, doing stuff as good as boys. And then I, from the very beginning, felt that I was not only equal to all the boys, but I was better. I mean, in a way, because I think the social, and right now they call it propaganda, but the social ideology was such that Mao Zedong said that women could hold half of the sky for all his women's liberation platform. I think that is the dominant ideology of the time. And then later on, I studied the model theater, the model plays, the eight plays, and you can see that all the women's images in those plays representing the strong women and women can do what men can do. So that's a predominant ideology at the time.
I want to talk more about women and in particular women in the arts as we get deeper into the interview. But one of the things I read that you made a comparison between, you said, look, if people aren't aware of what happened in pre-revolutionary China, the position of women was just horrendous, from just the objectification of women, the most grotesque things like the bound feet and the position of women in relation to the patriarchal thinking and ideological positions around that. And you made a comparison where you said it was very interesting to you that the first thing they did in China after the revolution, the first law that they passed was the marriage law. And some of the points that you made about why that was so significant. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I said I always compare the three generations of women in my family because usually people will say, why you have to think about that? I think sometimes your own experiences that can show a great deal of that. My both grandmothers on both sides, my mother and my father, they're both literate. They were both born at the turn of the 20th century, and they both married very early. In that interview, I said that one at the age of 14, another at age of 15. Yes, they both had bound feet, and each of them gave birth to 14 kids. And then the marriage was arranged, both, and then they both are illiterate. That I don't think they did anything more in their life than raising kids and giving birth to kids. And three of my mother's brothers died in infancy, so when they were infants. So that's what my grandmother's life, both. And my mother's life, the second generation, is totally different. He was born at the turn of the 30s. So basically, when the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949, she was a teenager and she was ready to go to college. The next year, she went to college to study Russian, dreaming to be a diplomat, to study in Moscow at that point. And then I think that both my parent generation, both my father and my mother, or the first generation got college education. So my mother was a translator and researcher in Russian literature before she retired. And when I grew up, I was more ambitious than my mother, I think, because I feel that my mother knew three languages. She speaks Chinese and Russian and English. So I aimed high. I have to take more because I studied Russian and German before I took up English and then French. So it's very interesting. I always look at that to see why three generations. Basically, we covered 20th century because my grandparents were born at the turn at the beginning of the 20th century. And then I think my mother and I enjoyed greatly, really, from the Communist Revolution.
Well, tell me this. You were talking about the individual stories and the social context that they were in. But in particular, in relation to the social context, the importance of something like the marriage law. I mean, to me, it was phenomenal. In fact, it really struck me when you said that it wasn't the Constitution, it wasn't any other law, it was the marriage law that got changed. And that was a very important thing. Can you tell people what the marriage law was and why it was so important?
Okay. So when after the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949, the second year, the central government passed two laws for the new China. Number one, in May, that was the marriage law. So the marriage law, for the first time in Chinese history, deemed that arranged marriage, selling for women, concubinage system, all illegal. And it advocated, it says that the men and women should be equal. The family is a place that men and women should help each other. And it's also the freedom of choosing your spouse for the first time in Chinese history. After the marriage law is issued, then all this, you know, at that point, some guys still have concubines, so they have to choose one wife, basically. So that exercised great impact on the women's lives. And of course, a month later, the second law was issued, that is the land reform law. So you can see Mao Zedong's caring for the peasantry, because at that time, peasants occupy, consist of 90% of Chinese population. And then it's land reform law. So I always look at that. It's because the first marriage law represented the Chinese Communist Party the changing of ideology, changing the social superstructure of society, try to use law to regulate what is kind of a gender relation would be, and also familial relation would be. And of course, the land reform law was the first one to deal with the base, economic base, that you have to give peasants the land in order to build a nicer society. Give every peasant a piece of land, that is.
Now, we'll come back to the peasantry in a minute, but I want to pursue one more thing in relation to women, because you had that happen in the beginning of the People's Republic of China, in the beginning of revolutionary China. Mm-hmm. But then you had to have there was a further leap that happened when the Cultural Revolution developed. What was the content of that? What difference did it make to women that the Cultural Revolution unfolded the way it did?
I think the Cultural Revolution started right now. People say, what is the intention of Mao's Cultural Revolution? I sincerely believe that Mao feels that the continuous revolution, because after the communists took over the country and made all China, everything's state-owned, that is collectively owned. However, people have to change their thinking, they have to get rid of the old ideas and old thought. So, and also, if people didn't do that continuously, and then the capitalists will return, a feudalism would return. So that may be the purpose of Mao's Cultural Revolution. And I think for women, the Cultural Revolution further strengthened the idea that women and men are equal. I think that before the Cultural Revolution, 17 years after the founding of the People's Republic, there was 17 years there, women made a great stride in terms of emancipation, in terms of their achievement in different areas of life, different walks of life. But in the Cultural Revolution, I think that was the peak in Chinese history. Right now, I'm writing a book on that. The women's liberation in the Cultural Revolution in several fronts. Number one, the images, the mass media. They build up women's images as heroic figures rather than wives and the concubines and fragile beauties. They were revolutionaries. They were constructors for the socialist revolution, socialist construction. That's number one. Number two, in the political spectrum, and Cultural Revolution asked for three combinations, that kind of a leadership for each unit or each province or each city. If you want to have a new government, revolutionary government, you have to have a women's representation. So that was the first time the women really in the leadership in every level of government.
One of the things I wanted to ask you in relation to all this is that the common picture of the Cultural Revolution is that it was like hordes of fanatical teenage zealots who were running through the countryside and sort of ideologically enslaving people, enslaved themselves, ideologically enslaved. They were running through the cities, the countries, and they were just turning China into a very robotic society with just straight thinking, repeating the religious catechism of Mao thought. And that's the image that's put there. And so what was your experience? How would you counter that? What was it like in relation to that?
I think that if you think the whole process of Cultural Revolution, it was 10 years, right? That right now they think about Cultural Revolution is 10 years. I always feel that when you think about young people went to countryside, all these, that's in the first few years. The Red Guards movement only lasted, I think, for about 2 or 3 years. And then, so to answer your question, I think that there are two moments, that historical moments in that 10 years, that young people would go down to the countryside, to the factories. One is in 1966. That's the Red Guards movement. Okay. The second one is the Sendang youth. That is the educated youth were sent down to the countryside in order to be re-educated by the peasants. So I'm not sure which one you're mentioning.
First, let me remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And I'm speaking today with Bai Di, the director of Chinese and Asian Studies at Drew University, the co-editor of Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up During the Mao Era. We're going to take a short break and be right back to continue our conversation with Bai Di. Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate. Today we're talking with Bai Di, a woman who grew up in revolutionary China, took part in the Cultural Revolution, and speaks out in defense of the Cultural Revolution as something that was very good, not just for the Chinese people, but for all of humanity. One of the things I'm trying to understand is that, and I think maybe I posed the question a little oddly when I asked it, but when you're talking about this youth going to the countryside, I think I told you the other day when we were first speaking that I just saw this movie called Turning Point 1977. And the whole idea there was that the youth who went to the countryside were so terribly oppressed that going to the countryside was like a prison sentence. They spent 11 years there, and when Deng Xiaoping came in and signed the law that said they were reinstituting the college entrance exam and everybody would be able to take it and get into college based on their scores, that there was just this widespread elation among the students, and they couldn't get out of the countryside fast enough. Were you sent to the countryside?
Yes.
Can you tell us what?
I was not sent to. Mm-hmm. I volunteered.
Okay, well, that's even better. That's even better. Let's talk about that because, you know, that's the thing that people get is like that couldn't have happened. She volunteered? Come on. Why did you volunteer and what did you find when you got there?
See, you have to think about the mode of the era. I always felt that I was a revolutionary. I was about to make a change in the society. So when I was graduating from middle school or high school, you call it, I was 16 years old. And that's in 1971 already. And then the state had a policy at that point that you could stay in the city to be a worker or to do whatever the situation allowed. And then I was the firstborn, so I supposed to be staying in Harbin, in the city. But I didn't like it. I always think that I should go to the countryside because people at that time, the educated youth, was sent down to the countryside in order to receive the re-education from the peasants. So Mao's idea was that the youth, especially from urban areas, they had very limited understanding of society. In other words, they were privileged. When you're privileged and you didn't understand 80% of the Chinese population, that is peasants, so you should go there to understand what is the reality of China and what can you do to help those people. And then, so that was the Mao's calling for the educated youth to go to the countryside. That started in 1964, before the Cultural Revolution. But then the massive educated youth would go to the countryside starting in 1968. And I didn't really catch up with that because I was a bit younger. But when my time came, and I just say, hey, I want to go to the countryside because I feel that, number one, maybe my ideology was not that pure because it's sometimes I've got kind of bourgeois, this and that, because I came from, I was born into an intellectual family. So I feel that I needed to be re-educated by the peasant. At the same time, and then we firmly believe at that point that the steel is tempered. You cannot get strong without trying times. And then what can be trying times at that point is a physical labor. Basically, if you go to the countryside, you really have to work hard in the field, use hoes or use sickles. So that kind of physical labor. So I think that I should go there to do that. But then I went to the countryside. I went to this farm, and that was the year that I didn't write in my book, but then that was the most memorable time in the time of my life, because we were very idealistic. We were very tired every day. We worked like 10 hours in the field, but we were singing songs, and we feel that we used our own hands. We're making something. We were making something. We're not a parasite anymore. I don't know why we thought we were a parasite, because from you were born until a certain age, you're a consumer, right? You're a consumer of other people's labor. At that point, it was just that feel of love to work. I think that drove me to the countryside. And then basically, I was forced back. The whole group, like 700 people. And the next year in 1972, and then the municipal government came over and said, no, we want you to be a teacher. We want to train you to be foreign language teachers or something. And we all boycotted. We said, no, we want to stay here.
Boy, that's a very different picture than what's normally presented. Interesting. When you were talking about this, you brought up the thing about the intelligentsia and you said your self-perception of maybe you were parasites, and then you thought, I don't know why we thought that. One of the things I was kind of curious about, because this is also something that's oftentimes used to vilify the Cultural Revolution, is that the Cultural Revolution meant that people's thinking was confined to a red box, that critical thinking, exploration in arts and science and other forms of human endeavor and knowledge, that those kinds of things were ruled out of order, and that everybody more or less had to become basically Maoist robots, or, and that was in order to thrive, and if you didn't, then you would be in big trouble. What was your experience in that?
I feel that that's a misrepresentation, because to think about science and technology, I think China's atom bomb and then the hydrogen bomb and also the satellite, all these high-tech stuff really happened during the Cultural Revolution. We have to say that, okay? So I think that the engineers and the technical, in that regard, they were still developing. In terms of ideological, that side, I feel that it's the opposite. I feel that the Cultural Revolution, the very first, Chairman Mao asked the young people, or for that matter, the people, all China, to have a critical mind, that you don't be a kind of slavery into some ideology. I think Mao said, you know, the rebellion is the right way to doing things. So I started to challenge what my mother said, what my father said, whether they are okay or not, at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. And I feel that my generation is very critical. Even when I came to the United States and people said, oh, you didn't like that you went through Cultural Revolution because it seemed that you're very critical of everything. And I said, that's exactly trained in the Cultural Revolution. You analyze and you use your own thinking. I think that's what Mao thought. That mm-hmm. makes sense?
Yes, absolutely. Now explain something to me, though. You know, the other thing related to this is that in terms of this, there's the critical thinking aspect. And then there's also the idea that somehow society was totally regimented and that there wasn't the kind of debate and dissent and discussion that would, you know, humans would want to live in that kind of society full of that kind of discussion and debate. What was your experience in the Cultural Revolution? Was it a very gray society and one-dimensional and just sort of you did what you were told, even if you were critically thinking, if there were some people? How did this play itself out among the masses of people broadly?
I think there's two sides. I mean, some people may never like kind of a thinking or something. I don't know that, because I think that always, you know, see, the Cultural Revolution, you have to have revolution in your everyday life. You have to do self-criticism all the time. I don't think a lot of people like that. That's really true, especially intellectuals, if they live a very privileged life. And then the revolution came, and since it's called the revolution, like Chairman Mao said, it's not to invite people to dinner. Let's just have a talk. It's sometimes could be violent. The revolution will result in change, violent change. tremendous changes. And some people may not like changes that much because they're in a privileged position. But then for the most people, I feel that for me, I think that it's the most free thinking period of my life. Seriously, I used a superlative degree because we are criticized a lot of things. And we started to learn the world affairs, to understand what is the U.S. and Martin Luther King that came up. So I don't know. I feel that it's a lot. But maybe for some people, if their privileges were challenged, then maybe they just feel bad. Mm-hmm. And then that's really true. I think there was a kind of a sense that is, you have to do the right thing. You have to do the self-criticism. And you have to always think about your position in the society. Mm-hmm. And then now, what can you contribute? And you always feel kind of bad if you couldn't contribute to something. I think that's really later on. I think sometimes cultural revolution really later on really push to some kind of a extreme in a way that is really, really bothers some people. I think that's why after the cultural revolution, so-called the scar literature came back, and a lot of people say, hey, I never liked to be a revolutionary, and I was like hijacked to be one.
So the scar literature is this seemingly endless series of books that talk about how terribly oppressed people were during the Cultural Revolution, their personal experiences of oppression. That's what you're referring to as scar
literature.
Exactly.
Yeah. In the 80s, and especially in the 80s, because in the 90s in China, the trend changed because they came back. And with the early 90s, there's a Mao phase and Mao fad or something. So people started to respect more of Mao Zedong. But then in the 80s, in that 10 years, and I feel that was where all these people came out writing about the terrible times in the Cultural Revolution. But for me, I feel the two things about that period, because I'm teaching the literature of that period right now. Number one is that those who wrote literature were the targets, actually, of the revolution, of the Cultural Revolution. So they were intellectuals, they were cadres. So that was the revolution tried to criticize. So after they came back, their experiences would be vastly different from the experiences of the workers and peasants and masses of the Cultural Revolution. But they had a pen, they could write, they had this discursive power. Mm-hmm. Number two, I think that the scholar literature later on also served as ideological support for Deng Xiaoping's so-called economic reform, because they have to repudiate the previous experience in order to legitimize his turning back to the capitalist kind of economy.
I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm the host of the show, Michael Slate. And today I'm talking with Bai Di, the director of Chinese and Asian Studies at Drew University and the co-editor of Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up During the Mao Era, a really fascinating book. And we're talking about the Cultural Revolution and a reassessment, a reappreciation of the Cultural Revolution. Very, very different from the kinds of horror stories that are constantly propagated. We're going to take a short break and be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate. That was a gypsy version of the Internationale. It's a beautiful, beautiful version, in the music and the culture of the Roma people. And we're talking today with Bai Di, Director of Chinese and Asian Studies at Drew University and a co-editor of the book Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up During the Mao Era. We're talking about the Cultural Revolution, the truth versus the lies and slanders that have been propagated about that era. Now, Di, when we left off, you were talking about the role of the intellectuals in society, and perhaps some of these people that were writing the scar literature were targeted by the Cultural Revolution. And you made some comments about the intellect, that there was some sort of targeting of intellectuals during that period. And I think in my own mind, and I know Bob Avakian has done a lot of work around this in terms of the Cultural Revolution, while overwhelmingly positive, really want to uphold that in terms of the human experience, in terms of the effort to get to the emancipation of humanity, it was an overwhelmingly positive development. But at the same time, there were things that were weaknesses in it. And some of them seemed to be some of the stuff about the role of the intelligentsia, the role of dissent in society, and the role of you know, how do you actually look at working with intellectuals in relation to discovering the truth and using that to change the world. Now, I wanted to ask you, and you also studied a lot around this question of art. I think that crosses over into this, you know, it connects up with the thing that we've just been talking about. And if you have any comments on what I just said, but also then sort of speak a little bit about how people in the arts, actually, what role did art play in the Cultural Revolution?
Okay, the first part of the Chinese intellectuals. So Chinese intellectual tradition is a very interesting one, you think about it, because intellectual is a word that means, which is different from scholar, from academician. Yeah. So I think intellectual carries the connotation of to fight for social justice, to use their knowledge to take care of society, and to be the guard of what happened. I think that's the modern sense of intellectual. But for Chinese intellectuals, I think after the founding of the People's Republic of China, they all tried to be intellectuals rather than scholars. But before that, I just want to say, before the revolution, that is the turn of the 20th century, there was no such concept as intellectuals. Everybody was a scholar. So in the Cultural Revolution, I think that Mao tried to push that. So your intellectuals, your job was not only to sit there to study how one character is written, his history or something. At the same time, you should have a social consciousness. You should have a certain kind of consciousness. And Mao feel that the intellectuals should have the consciousness of the people. And that's one thing. And another part is that the Chinese intellectual or intelligentsia class from the ancient times on, or the scholar class, always have this kind of elitist attitude. That came from Confucianism. Confucius said that only the people with education could reach this gentlemanhood, I mean, to be the perfect people, to be the perfect person. But then if people didn't have education, then they are little people, they are vulgar people. So Mao tried to say, hey, wait a minute, let's get rid of a Confucian tradition. You're intellectuals, you've been studying, you have a knowledge, but then at the same time, you shouldn't look down upon the masses. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the point, and that's why in the Cultural Revolution, or even before that, in the Yan'an era, in the 40s, and Mao asked the intellectuals to go to live with the peasants, with the masses, and then come back to write their literature, to write their policies. So that's Mao's idea for Zheng Feng, of a thought reformation, a thought reform for the intellectuals. And I think that went throughout his career, throughout Mao's career.
Okay, well, before we get into the arts, let me develop my questioning on that a little bit more. One of the things I wanted to ask was, you know, there's also a common perception of, or misperception of what went on during the Cultural Revolution in relation to the struggle around with the intelligentsia and with other forces in society. The idea that there was, that this was a very violent episode in Chinese history. That's a very, very popular misconception, I think. Yeah, I know you have your own experience. I mean, from reading your story in Some of Us, your father was one of the people who was actually targeted as a person to struggle against, and he was an intellectual. And there was a whole episode there. Can you talk about what was the truth, is it a lie or is it true in terms of this, the way, the methods of struggle against the intelligentsia or against other people? And again, this conception that
oh, it was all just murderous hordes. It was a very violent episode in Chinese history.
I feel that in 1966, there was that kind of, that violence was there because of the Red Guards movement. It's not the violence of had killed all the people, but then uncertainty, of course, was there because you didn't know what happened. I think my father's a very interesting person. Actually, last night I talked to him. Recently, I told him a long time ago that I was in this left movement or something. He was totally supportive. And recently, he was very, he is very active in that. He's 80 years old already. But he's been logged on all this Chinese New Left's website, reading all this, criticizing right now the capitalist kind of thing. And he realized, because he fought a little bit when he was very little, very young, fought in the anti-Japanese war, and he was the first, among the first generations of being educated by Chinese Communist Party. Basically, he was raised and by the Chinese Communist Party. And right now, when he was struggled against, I wrote about that, and he was the first to pick up by the Red Guards, saying he was a capitalist voter. At that point, he was a vice president of a university at the beginning of a Cultural Revolution. And for 3 years, he was out of jail, I mean, out just working to sweep the floor or something. But I think after 1969, after the Ninth Congress of the Chinese Communist Party, and he just was restored and took his position, and then so that was that. But recently, I mean, I and my father talk constantly about this whole thing. He was very interesting. He totally felt that was legitimate, that Red Guards just struggled against him, would pick him up. And then for him, he said when he joined the revolution, Communist Revolution, and when he vowed to join the Chinese Communist Party, he was thinking to liberate all the people before their own liberation. So that's a very Marxist idea. But he said along the line, after the founding of the People's Republic of China, and then his class, the cadre class, really changed. Really, really changed because they care about their own interests more than the interests of masses. So, and he felt that it's legitimized. I mean, there's a legitimacy in doing that. And for him, the Cultural Revolution really knocked him up and said, hey, wake up. You promised when you joined the Chinese Communist Revolution to do this, but you didn't. You took care of yourself. You become selfish. You didn't care about the masses. And then that was wrong. So for him, he was a very, very, very interesting person, but I feel that maybe he influenced me a lot in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that, I don't want to keep pounding at this, but I think it's important because it's actually, we did a show last week that was Raymond Lotta was speaking about communism, and the theme of the show was everything you've been told about communism is wrong, and of course, the Cultural Revolution and Mao were a big part of it. And we got a caller who said, wait a minute, 80 to 90 million people were killed in the Cultural Revolution. And that is not, you know, as bizarre as that sounds to me, that's not uncommon for people to think that there was just widespread slaughter. And I know you said that there was some violence, and I understand that there was some violence, including some by reactionary forces who were taking advantage of the situation or trying to
right.
impose their thing. But when people say to you, 80 to 90 million Chinese people were killed in the Cultural Revolution, what do you say?
I think that's really ridiculous. Now think about the population, okay? We have a population when the Chinese Cultural Revolution started in 1966. There were about 650 million people in China, okay? And then after 10 years, and the population increased to 800 million. That's why immediately after the Cultural Revolution, Deng Xiaoping's reform, what the first thing, among the first things he did, was family control, family planning. It's very, very strict family planning because there were so many people, too many people in China. So I'm thinking the math just didn't add up, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it had been nearly one out of every eight person died, then why there was a family planning after immediate after Cultural Revolution in 1979? That policy was in place. So I think that also is that the same thing that is right now. I think in the United States they talk about the 3 years famine in China in from 1959 to 1962. They said I don't know how many tens of million people died or something. I feel that's just not true. Of course people died, but I don't think numbers that much. But you can inflate the number. I just I lived through that. I don't. So the reason I'm asking people, do you feel that anybody around you died? Maybe one or two. I mean, some of the professors commit suicide or something. There were deaths, that's for sure. But I would never think that is 80 million or something, mm-hmm. but that's a too large number, mm-hmm. even for China's population.
When you think about it, the idea that the Cultural Revolution was mainly a sort of a band of thugs unleashing violence against the people, as opposed to really widespread and deep political struggle that you know took a lot of mass forms where people were engaged actively in huge debates and struggles over critical questions of the day. You know, that's what I think the struggle is. How do you actually present the Cultural Revolution? Was it just a gang of thugs, or was it actually widespread upheaval in society that disrupted all of the norms?
Yeah, that's really true. Recently, there's a new research on the Beijing's high schools. Most of the beating deaths really happened there. And then who beat those people to death? And then they found out those people are the children of so-called capitalist rulers. Very interesting. Yeah, so that's a different kind of a history, but I feel that it's just a lie because you bury people every day? That's a lot of people, I think, 18 million. I never thought of that. I mean, I never heard of this. Only recently I heard that they gave a number.
It's actually true. You would think with a number like that, somebody would have noticed. Well, now let's move on to this because we're running up on our time, and I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm Michael Slate, the host of the show, and today we're talking with Bai Di, the director of Chinese and Asian Studies at Drew University and one of the co-editors of Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up During the Mao Era. And we're talking about the Cultural Revolution, what's true about it, what's lies and slanders, and why it's important that people have an objective and true understanding of what was concentrated in that period of history. We're going to take a short break and be right back to continue our conversation with Bai Di. Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm Michael Slate, your host. Today we're talking with Bai Di, a woman who grew up in revolutionary China and took part in the Cultural Revolution. And she's speaking out in defense of the Cultural Revolution as something that was very good, not just for the Chinese people, but for all people everywhere. Now, Di, one question I did want to get into in the time we have remaining, and we probably have time for a couple more questions, but one I wanted to get into was the role of art. And you've paid some attention to how art changed in the Cultural Revolution. And, you know, again, there's a common misperception or misconception of art in the Cultural Revolution. A lot of times people just think it was all sort of that hammer that you hit people over the head with, the idea that it was just forcing people to all think one way. But there were some really amazing things that happened in the arts during the Cultural Revolution. Can you talk about the art in the Cultural Revolution and some of those things that happened?
Yeah, you know, actually, the Cultural Revolution started with the literature, with the art reform, really. I feel that two things. Number one is that when I started the model theater, that is the eight revolutionary ballet, two revolutionary ballets and six Peking operas, and they were regarded as the model plays for all the art workers emulate, so their ideals represented in those. So I started to write about this in the early 90s in the United States because I feel that that's a part of me, because where my family has come from, there's women's liberation, and my own identity is really attached to that because I grew up singing those and acting those parts in the model theater. I feel that starting from the Cultural Revolution, the art and the singing and painting and singing and dancing became a popular endeavor. It's very interesting to see a whole nation that everybody would perform and would sing some songs and would paint and would have a competition of painting and drawing. And I feel that that's a very big part of Chinese tradition, but it was never put into use, and I think put into reality. Even Confucius said music can elevate people, can make people feel sublime, feel idealistic, feel great about their future, about their life. I think the Cultural Revolution started with a kind of a mass-produced songs and images and posters, and everybody joined the whole thing. Okay. And right now, people said it's only not many productions of the art in the Cultural Revolution, which was totally wrong, because I think right now the most sung song in China are still the songs in the Cultural Revolution right now. Yeah, in this year, basically. And then the most beautiful paintings and the most creative paintings right now for the 60 years of the People's Republic, still the products from the Cultural Revolution. And recently I was in China for a conference about the 60 years of Chinese literature, and we had to all agree, whether you're from left, from liberal, from right side, and then the Cultural Revolution's 8 model theater, model plays, are the peak of China's creation of art in modern history.
Hmm. My own familiarity, my own exposure to the model operas that were done, I mean, it was really incredible. And even comparing it, not just to what existed on a stage in China, but what exists in any society, especially a society like this, where the role of women in film and in theater and whatnot is generally a very, very oppressive role. The kind of, you know, not that role where women are oppressing people, but they are deeply oppressed, the kind of roles that they have. And it's the sort of fake femininity, the idea that the sexualization of women, the objectification of women, the weakness of women, the dependency on the male, and the special roles in society. But in these model operas, that was all broken through. And I remember being really stunned by the portrayal, the strong portrayal of women that was put forward in those operas. I'm thinking of White-Haired Girl and Red Detachment of Women, just incredible things. And even changing the dance form, you know, which was really interesting to me, even changing the form of the ballet. That actually became much stronger and was actually much more. Women were no longer the dainty creatures skipping across the stage, but were actually taking very powerful positions in dance.
Yeah, that's true. Recently, I showed my students the ballet White-Haired Girl, and everybody's shocked. So, wow, that was beautiful. And I said, it's a beauty in that. It's not only because, I mean, the strong women's images, but also the artistic representation of that. And I think it's very convincing that women and men are equal, and women could be the revolutionary successors, and women are the revolutionaries rather than the wives. So I think that the model theater, all these model plays, really, in terms of women, broke away from even the Communist China that is from 1949 to 1966, from that representation, the breakaway from that and improved on those plays. All the 8 model plays were revisions from a play already exists. What is revised is really trying to get the women to be the major characters, the heroes in those plays. And some, like the Red Azalea, the one of the Peking operas, the original play, the Chinese Communist Party's party secretary was a man. And in the model theater, they changed into women. See, all these kind of changes in order to say that women are the part of Chinese Revolution. Women are the heroic figure of that. I think that's really exercised great, great influence on all the women growing up in that era. So that also has a cultural revolution. You think about changing a culture. You use the images to show that this is the woman we should be. That will fundamentally change Confucian ideas of women can only be compared with the slaves, that kind of ideology. And I think that especially the healthy kind of strong images in that, I think it's everlasting, basically, for the Cultural Revolution model theater.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, too, because I know somewhere you mentioned Zhang Jing's role in particular, and I thought I was really fascinated by that and the fact that actually, you know, Zhang Jing, actually, what she did in terms of radicalizing and revolutionizing theater and opera and art in general was just incredible. And she has become one of the most demonized individuals in the history of the world. But at the and in spite of that, you know, if you look at the truth of it, she actually was somebody who was really out on the revolutionary edge of trying to create a whole new world.
Yeah, I think China and all, for that matter, all cultures want to demonize women, blaming women for whatever the problems, right? I mean, throughout Chinese history, every dynasty fell, and then there's a woman to complain, to blame. Mm-hmm. And I think Jiang Qin the same thing. I think in my dissertation, which finished in the mid-90s, I said Jiang Qin was the quintessential Chinese feminist, period, because she single-handedly changed the whole landscape of Chinese literature and the cultural representation. I think her involvement in revision of the all these eight plays really put the woman into that prominent place. And also, she had a certain kind of sense of beauty in that. The beauty does not lie right now to how pale your skin was, how thin your waist or whatever, those kind of things. It's really strong because the purpose of revolution theater is really try to promote the kind of healthy images for women, which was denied throughout Chinese history.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dee, one quick question, and then we'll just have to wrap it up. But one of the things that I think really stood out to me about the Cultural Revolution, I was thinking about you in terms of your childhood and your growing up and coming of age from the time of the beginning of the Cultural Revolution and then 1972 and through to 76 and all. And that was a period of really tremendous turmoil in the world. And the one thing that always stood out to me, and I know a lot of friends in Africa felt the same way, that when you look to China, it seemed to be a country where the fate of the people of the world was foremost in a lot of people's minds, that whole idea of internationalism and that the Chinese people were not alone, but were actually standing with people all over the world who were fighting for a better world. Can you comment on that?
I think so. I think even one of the model theaters, the Dock, on the Dock, is talk about the internationalism. And I feel that China at that point, especially with Mao, and then it seemed that you have the world inside you. To be a person, to be born into the world, you have to take the responsibility of that. That means to helping to make a fair and just society, not only in China, but throughout the world. That's what his Mao's three world kind of, theory. And I feel that at that point, and that we always felt that we have this obligation to change the world into a kind of an equal society. I think that's very utopia. I told my students that I said, even in the United States, are you for a fair distribution? I don't use the equal distribution. I said fair distribution of social wealth. And all our students are here at Drew said, no, that's too bad. But I said, when I was a child, I mean, that was the idea that you shouldn't have that much. And look at the Africa, and we sincerely felt that we should share. So that's why the idea that we didn't like capitalism that much, because the capitalism seemed so greedy in a way, and seemed that didn't have a larger picture of humankind as a whole in that way, because you try to set a self-centeredness. And I think that Mao Zedong was very good at that, and then I know this is called the three most cited works from Mao Zedong. One is In Memory of Norman Bethune. Bethune was a Canadian communist who died in China for helping the war, China's war against Japan. And Mao said, it's very clearly, he said, everybody should have that Bethune's selflessness. And he said, a man's ability can be great or small, but if that person has a spirit of selflessness, and that person will be noble-minded and pure, a man of moral integrity, and all vulgar interests, would do great things for the world. So we're all inspired by that, and we feel that there is no boundary of nation-state. And all of us human beings, maybe it's too utopian, but I feel that was the feeling of the age. Yeah.
Not too utopian, Dee. In fact, it's a much-needed ethos today, more than ever.
I agree.
Yeah. All right, Dee, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Sure, absolutely. We'll have to have you back sometime soon. I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate. And I've been talking today with Bai Di, the Director of Chinese and Asian Studies at Drew University, co-editor of Some of Us, Chinese Women Growing Up During the Mao Era. That about wraps it up for today. I'm Michael Slate, and this is the Michael Slate Show. And think about this, what we've been talking about today, the importance of actually knowing the truth about what happened in China and what happened in the Cultural Revolution, but knowing the truth about how the world actually runs. Because if you can't get the truth, you'll never be able to imagine a different world. And if you can't imagine a different world, you'll never be able to bring one into being. That's the importance. That's literally the importance. The fate of humanity hangs on whether or not we are able to actually understand the truth and utilize that truth in the service of emancipating all of humanity. That's what it's all about. I'm Michael Slate. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in. And until next week, take care.